Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org. It's the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. That's everywhere, folks. It's mostly unknown. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse. They afford us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the nation, so does the country, and you know what? So does the world. Most of the problems today in our society is based on children who did not get proper instruction. They did not learn proper principles. Latchkey kids, I don't know if they're still using that term.
It yeah,
coming
they
up when I was growing. They are? Okay. It means that both parents have to work or need to work to sustain a standard of living sufficient to the social order that they find themselves living today. To have a house, two cars, flat screen TV, all the amenities, et cetera, feed food for the children. Children are very expensive propositions. But the expense is really coming in because there's no one there to teach the kids. So we throw them off to school, and because the parents don't have the time or the knowledge or the ability, they send it off to the – well, they have the ability, probably not the knowledge or the interest. They send their kids off to school, and they expect the teachers to take care of this problem. Of course, all the teachers get out of that is a problem, because the teachers can't really discipline children, and who's better than the parents? So we have a lot of these families, dysfunctional families. The families are being beset on all sides. You go to the prisons, most of the time, Harold goes to the prison, my co-host. He goes to the prisons weekly, bringing the message of 12-step recovery. And I have found from in the prisons, most of the folks in there are drug and alcohol related. Very few career criminals. They're there, but it's not really a lot of them. Most of these crimes are done of crimes of opportunity that involve drugs and alcohol. So anyway, having said that, Harold, how you doing tonight?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joseph, for that introduction. And it is true, their motto, as my motto when I was messed up 25 years ago, my motto was, it sounded like a good idea at the time. We never think we're going to get caught. You know, a lot of the people in jail and prison are there because of drugs and alcohol. If not directly, it's indirectly. And my first sponsors asked me to think about something. He said, isn't it true that not every time you drank did you get in trouble, but every time there was big trouble, there was alcohol or drugs involved? And I had to admit that was true. That's how we get to the point where we can realize there is a problem, there is a dependency. So working with the families is really, really necessary. That's how it was done back in the old days, in the 30s and 40s, when Bill W. and Dr. Bob met and the whole thing took off. They worked with families. They would also work with the alcoholic, but they didn't omit the family. And it's real hard to find anybody these days who's willing to go out and work with the families. So I've made that my occupation and my passion to see what we can do to really help the families. It is a family disease, and it is a family solution. So it's an honor for me to be in the situation with the opportunity to help families. It's my way of giving back. And this program and your website are also ways of giving back. I just want everyone to know that this Joseph does not make money from this venture, this website. The website is called rumradio.org, and Joseph make any money. It costs him thousands to keep the website up and to keep improving it, and so I applaud him for that. And this also, coming on the radio like this, there's an expense to that. And but that's his way of giving back. This is my way of giving back. Oh, by the way, we do have the chat room up, so if you go to rumradio.org, on the upper right, you'll see the word live. Click there, and you can find the chat room on Rum Radio, on our live program. So thanks for doing this week after week, Joseph. I know we have over 1,000 listeners who tune in through the archive, and so... if you're listening live, you can either chat with us, or you can ask questions or make comments. So, Joseph, do you want to give the phone number at this point?
Yes, sure, Harold. 949-534-0621. And in New Jersey, it's 949-534-0621. 0621. Something that you had said reminded me, it was a Trish Murphy refrain from one of her songs, and it went something like this. It started out as a double dog dare. The trouble with trouble is that it starts out as when you're young and dumb, the trouble with trouble is it starts out as fun. The trouble with trouble. I really like that. We don't make any money on this. It's a way of giving back. And I believe that this is my effort, and I believe it's in collaboration with God. There's 101% effort that's put into Rum Radio and Rum Radio Radio, and God does 101% of the effort, and I show up. And here I am. Tonight we have a guest. David's been with us before. He was last week. David is an old friend. I know David, I think about 12 years or so, and know him pretty well. I know a lot of his story. So it's going to be real interesting. We'd like to, before I introduce David and his story, I'd like to start off with the third step prayer. It's found on page 63 of the basic text of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this reminds me, we're not AA. We're not NA. We're not CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where to hold a meeting. And if you're able to hang in long enough for the show, you might even think it might have been Narcoleptics Anonymous. Anybody? We're Rum Radio, and that's it. We don't represent anybody, although we do use the Big Book as a template for all the 12-step programs, all the church 12-step programs, all the other 12-step programs, Overeaters, Gamblers Anonymous, all 12-step programs derive from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only difference is usually it's just the first step, which addresses the problem. The other 11 steps we call a design for living, which is the solution. So we like to concentrate on the solution. We live in the solution, not in the problem. I think that's real important. I tell my sponsees that. Usually when I take on a new sponsee, I tell them, I suggest, and we're big about suggestions, which is in a form of subtle command, but it's just a suggestion, and we suggest that they do certain activities to attain and maintain long-term recovery, not just sobriety. Our goal is to get into recovery. We think of man in thinking who says sobriety is enough. It's not enough. There's more to it than that, but that's the way we get started. And I suggest that he doesn't speak in the meeting until he's worked step five. Why step five? Because in the 12 and 12, which is part of our program understanding, it says, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So not only do you have to speak a fifth step, which is a form of acknowledging your past wrongs to someone, when two or three are gathered, I shall be amongst them. So it's like, okay, we're inviting a sponsor, a sponsee, and God. Wow, very spiritual, very enlightening, very true. It works really well. And so he gets it off his chest and to another human being. It has to be a human being. It's real specific about that. And once he's done that, now he's made it's the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. Then it says, until we've heard. Oh, so now we have to listen to a fifth step to belong. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor. So once we've gotten at least to the point where he said a fifth step, now we can talk to the meetings. He can share his experience, strength, and hope in the meetings. And I suggest to him that 1/12 of the 12 steps are the problem and 11/12 of the program is recovery, is the solution. Remind that percentage when you share in the meeting. We live in the solution, not in the problem. So one thing, when I first get a sponsee, I ask him certain questions. I call him a prospect initially. A prospect. It's in the Big Book. Go find a prospect and start working on him. That's what it says in the basic text. It doesn't ask for the prospect, which is a sales term, to come find the salesman. Makes no sense, does it? No, of course not. They come in, they have no idea. They don't know the jargon. They don't know the culture. They don't know what's expected of them. So the best we can do nowadays is the mantra, keep coming back. So eventually, if you've been in the meetings long enough, you might get this program through the process of osmosis. That's if you sit down in enough meetings, it comes out through the floor, up the legs of your chair, up your butt and into your head, and you got it. No, it doesn't work that way. This works best with a sponsor. One drunk talking to another drunk who's been able to attain some recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how it was designed. That's how it works the best. And I believe we're headed back that way. But it's a hard ship to turn, folks. Change comes hard, not just for the alcoholic. Everybody, nobody likes change. It's the only constant in the universe. So I asked my sponsee today. I think I'll tell you a little bit about that. Huh, Harold?
You bet. I think we should hear about Joseph had a God shot today, and I think we should share it with everybody.
Well, I was at church, and I'm a church going guy, and the church, the particular flavor of religion I belong to, they don't drink and they don't smoke. They don't even smoke. They don't drink coffee. They don't drink alcohol, and they don't smoke cigarettes. If to give you an idea who that might be, I'll give you a hint: Mitt Romney. And so I'm sitting. One of the chairs towards the back. I'm a back kind of guy. I think AA is like church. It fills up from the back and the sides. If you come in late, you're forced to the front. You know, that kind of deal. And I'm sitting there, and this fellow Franklin is sitting next to me. Really nice fellow. I think he's from Jamaica, and I've known him for a little while, but not personally. You know what I mean? So I'm sitting next to him, and all of a sudden I'm getting these little whiffs, these odoriferous signs of alcohol coming through his pores. Now, I've been around a while, so that helps. And I've experienced quite a bit in my life. And the first time I smelled it, I thought, well, maybe it's just dirty clothes or body odor or something. And then I get another whiff, and I get another whiff, and I'm going, you know what? That's alcohol. The alcohol was coming out through his pores. So after the meeting, I turned around to him. I put my arm around him. I says, Franklin, I smell alcohol coming out of your pores. Is that true? He looked at me like a deer in headlights. What was he going to do? He's in church. He believes that Jesus and being honest and all that. And here you are in the sanctuary. And he paused. And finally he said, yes, it is. And we took it off from there. I says, do you want to talk about it? He says, yes, I do. The chances of someone in that church sitting next to him that would even have noticed that, let me put it to you this way, there was no chance. So he realized, and I knew, this was a God deal. They happen all the time. Miracles happen all the time. I don't question them anymore. Matter of fact, I kind of expect them. So we went in, we found a room, and we had a nice chat, and right now he's a prospect. And what I asked him, certain questions, and the first question is, have you had enough? And I explained to him, and initially he said yes, because he was emotionally involved that this was transpiring. He was looking, he's lost his wife and he's lost his children, and he said, you know, if you lost your wife and your children kind of deal, I don't know if I cannot drink because of that. I said, Franklin, I says, it's not that you're drinking because you lost your wife and children. You're drinking because it's Sunday. You're drinking because it's Tuesday. You're drinking because you got up early or you got up late. You're drinking because, essentially, you like the effect of alcohol. And you get an ease and comfort from that first drink. He paused and said, yes, that's true. I said, so the rest of it is just excuses. Let's try to get over that. I'm going to ask you again, have you had enough? He said, yeah, I've had enough. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? He says, yes, I am. I tell him, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I had my note too. I have a pretty little note too. Smartphone, and it's still smarter than me, but I'm working through it. And I was able to bring up Rum Radio, and I gave him Clancy's 7 questions. He wrote them down, and I need them back tomorrow. So now he's still a prospect, and I let him know, you're a prospect until we get to the next. I'm qualifying a prospect. It's a sales term. Having a good chance of success, I need to qualify this guy. So now if I get him back tomorrow, then we're off to the races. And I ask him, I'll direct him to a home group Well, he'll get like maybe 20 or 30 names from men in his home group, men with men, women with women, when possible. If that's not possible, you know what we do? We work the steps. We sort it out later. The key is to work the steps. It's easier to identify with a same gender, and it's a very intimate relationship. So we don't want to confuse any issues. It's hard enough as it is. It's a simple program, but it's not easy. Why make it more complicated? So what we do at that point, I want you to call each man, a different man, every day for the next 30 days and recite the third step prayer. One, it gets you used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects you up with your fellowship. See, that's your lifeline. Your sponsor's not always going to be available, and you might need somebody to talk to, and here you got 20 or 30 names. Somebody will answer. Everybody's got a cell phone. Nobody ever answers, but with 30 names, you got a good shot. Somebody's going to answer down the road if you're persistent enough. And the third reason is that it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and getting a happy, joyous, and free life. And fourthly, the person he's calling might be thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, first hit of crack, you fill in the blank, and chances are he will not, no guarantee, but you got your sponsee already into service action, which we find to be the greatest immunity from alcohol, intensive work with another alcoholic. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Well, now this is... I know David from St. Teresa's. It was the Hilltoppers group in Austin. And like I said, I think it's about 10 or 12 years. David was a music producer at one time, the youngest engineer to be working at Aramco in Saudi Arabia. They, matter of fact, they changed the law to get him in there. He's had a varied experience. He's had some really hard times. He walked in at 12 years old and for his mother's suicide. He's battled with drugs and alcohol for a good part of his adult life. He sponsored, I don't know how many dozens of guys. He's been married several times. He's made and lost several fortunes. Wow, he sounds like one of us. So, David, how you doing tonight?
Ah, man, it's beautiful up here in the Rocky Mountains, I tell you. I'm doing real well.
Rocky Mountain High. Is that a Rocky Mountain High you got going?
Yeah, I do, and I just got back from my second meeting of the day. Did make it to noon and made it to the 5:45 and just jetted home as fast as I could to get here and get a bite to eat and then hook up with you.
Oh, great. Thank you. We appreciate so much for the effort. Well, tell us, the way we usually work this is what it was like. You know, your story, what happened and what it's like now and whatever your passion is, to keep you in maximum service to God and your fellows. So what was it like? Tell me in the beginning.
In the beginning, I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, Joseph, and I tell this to guys that I sponsor and I share at meetings too. In the beginning, you know, alcohol and drugs were fun for me. I had a lot of fun with them for a while, you know. I learned at a very early age that you mentioned, you know, that my mother committed suicide when I was 12. Well, you know, when I was at her funeral, I was so hysterical and I was just going crazy. I mean, I had never experienced anything like that before in my life, of course, at that age. And they couldn't get me out of the funeral car. So a doctor came over and gave me a shot of some kind of tranquilizer. And within about 45 seconds, all of a sudden, it was like all of my feelings went away. And it was like I had no troubles anymore. And it was my first experience with drugs or alcohol at the time that something could take that pain away. And I was able to just get out of the funeral car and walk over to my mother's casket and we finished the funeral and everything, and afterwards, you know, I mean, I wasn't hysterical anymore, and I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't distraught. I was, you know, a 10-year-old kid, and I just found my mother dead in the garage from carbon monoxide poisoning, you know. But this doctor gave me something that just took myself out of myself. You know, those of you out there know what I'm talking about. It just took it away. You know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You know, and then later on, you know, I got into high school and such, and of course, like a lot of people who grew up in the 60s and 70s, like myself, you know, I experimented with a lot of things, and you know, I had a lot of fun, especially in my college days. I had a lot of fun. I was a disc jockey at the biggest discotheque at the university town that I went to, and you know, people would come in there, and of course, I'm in a bar and I'm drinking every night, and you know, people are bringing in drugs and handing them to me, and alcohol and drinks all night long from the bar for free, and you know, it was a lot of fun. You know, but then this is what happened. The thrill was gone. The thrill was gone.
When did that happen, though? Try to be a little spirit. Okay, so you're in college, you're partying. I know you. David is really good with women. We make a joke out of it. It's kind of a joke. If any one of you remember Seinfeld episode about having the Gavorka.
The Gavorka.
Who was that character? Who was the Kramer?
Kramer had the
Gavorka, and they said that the Gavorka was the allure of the animal, and that women would go after Kramer. Now Kramer had no money; he wasn't particularly good looking. Although, not to cast aspersions on David. But for some reason, women, tell us the first story, like when you go to, women seem to gravitate towards David. To digress a bit, we were in a AA party kind of deal in Austin years ago, and David goes to sit back by this little fire in the back of this little ranchette. And within 5 minutes, the prettiest girl at the party is sitting next to David. And 5 minutes later, and she's giving him her phone number. Her husband sits down and she turns around to him and says, "We need to get to know this guy."
I would call
that the Gavorka. Because I know I have the anti-Gavorka, so I know what Gavorka looks like.
Joseph notices it. Like, we go in grocery stores. Joseph used to go in the grocery stores with me, and we'd be walking down the aisle, and Joseph would say, "Did you see that way that girl looked at you? She turned around when you walked by us, and she was staring at you walking down the aisle. I just don't notice it. You know, I just don't notice it, and I do. I'm not bragging, but I've just always had, women have always just been attracted to me. I don't know if it's my personality but it can't be, because they come out of nowhere. They don't even know me. But I've always had really good luck with very attractive women. I mean, he's got my wife who died several years ago posted, I think, up, and she's a very beautiful woman, and she was very spiritually beautiful, even more so inside than outside, you know. I didn't go after women just for their looks. That wasn't the kind of person I was, you know. But my mother.
Anyway,
so
all right. Yeah,
so anyway,
I'm sorry to divert a little bit. You're back in college and you're partying and you're a DJ.
I get out of college and I'm working, and my boss one day tells me, he says, "You know, David," he says, "you know, I smell alcohol on your breath every day when you come in here, you know." And he says, "You know, you may have a drinking problem." And I said, "You know, I think I kind of do, but, you know, I seem to function okay." He says, "Yeah, you're my number one engineer." And he said, "You know, I can get you a job in Saudi Arabia if you want to go to Saudi Arabia." He says, "But alcohol is illegal over there." And I thought that was my way out. I thought that's how I was going to stop drinking. I was going to move to Saudi Arabia. Alcohol was illegal. And I was going to be able to stop drinking. Well, my first day in Saudi Arabia, some friends that I had just met in the office, they said they're having a party up at the Air Force base here in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, tonight. Let's go. So we went up there, and I didn't know that alcohol was still legal on the Air Force base. That was the only place it was legal in the whole country, was on the Air Force base. So we're on the Air Force base.
Didn't you meet a woman right leaving the airplane?
Yes, the first night I was there, I met a woman and hooked up with a woman. And the guys in the camp always joked with me about that because they said, you know, we've been over here for 4 years, never met a woman yet. And the first week I was over here, I was living with a woman.
You were there 24 hours.
Yeah, I was living with a nurse the first week I moved over there. These guys have been there for 4 or 5 years and never even been introduced to a woman. So anyway, I think this is my way out, you know, just moving to Saudi Arabia. But I'm driving home from the Air Force base, man. This is a true story. I'm driving home from the Air Force base, and I'm drunk as hell. And I roll a company car. I drill it into a sand dune going back to the construction camp I was living on. And I walked back to camp and showed my pass and got through the gates, stumbling through the gates. Of course, it was Pakistanis that were manning the gates at that time, so luckily it wasn't Saudis, or I would have gotten thrown in jail. And it just so happens I was lucky because the president of the oil company, I graduated in his class with his twin son and daughter. They weren't identical twins, but they were twins, but they were in my class. And so I called him up. He was Dr. Schultz, and I said, Dr. Schultz, man, I rolled a company car, you know, and I told him that it's out in the desert. It's out there in the desert. What's going to happen? It's 25 years in jail if you get caught over there with alcohol or if you get caught for an alcohol-related offense. The next day I got up and woke up with a hangover. I was really hungover, and I walk out of my trailer. I was living in a trailer with 36 guys. There's a brand-new company truck there right out in front of my trailer with the same Arabic numbers on it. It looked exactly like my truck, the same numbered truck with the same numbers, all painted new and everything, and nobody ever knew that I rolled that truck. And the whole time I was over in Saudi Arabia, I drank. I started manufacturing liquor over there. I was making wine. I built the steel. That didn't stop me. That still didn't stop me, knowing I'm going in and out of gates on a daily basis where they spot check cars. And I got cases of wine and what they call Siddiqui, which is 200-proof liquor, in my trunk. And I could do 25 years in prison for that. I had a friend that got sentenced to 25 years in prison over there for that. And his family had to pay $500,000 to get him out of prison. After 3 years, they got him out. And 3 months later, he died of a heart attack. And
wow.
His family went into huge debt to get him out of that country, and then he died. Then he died as soon as he got back, you know. But anyway, so that wasn't enough. But when I got back from Saudi Arabia, I decided, you know, I'd had enough, man. I couldn't face myself in the mirror anymore. You know, it's one of those things, you hear people talk about that all the time. I was waking up in the mornings, and I just kept saying, you know, David, you just can't keep living like this, man. You know, you're going to kill yourself. You're going to kill somebody on the road. Something bad's going to happen, you know. So I got introduced to a friend of mine to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in Houston at the time. This is back in the early 80s, 1981. It was my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And you know, and I heard some things that kind of stuck with me, you know. But back then, it was a lot of old-timers, and I just didn't feel like I fit in. I was still young. I was still in my my late 20s at that time, and it was a bunch of old farts with big warts on their faces, you know, and they were just talking, I spilled more than you drank and that kind of stuff, you know, and that stuff really turned me off, you know. Because I looked at one on one day, I got really pissed at this guy. He said, you know, I spilled more than you drank. And I said, you know what, you SOB, the only reason you spilled more than I drank is because you were a sloppy drinker. You couldn't hold on to your glass. You know, I drank just as much as you did. I earned my seat in here, you know. And I managed to stay sober for about 3.5 years, and then I started drinking again. And then,
guys,
and
then the old guys are just jealous because you got in there when you were relatively young, you know?
Yeah. So then the oil.
Well, you were the youngest. Didn't they change the law to get you in there?
Yes, when I went to Saudi Arabia, you had to be 25 years old to get a permanent work visa to work in Saudi Arabia, and I was only 24. So they brought me into the country at 24, and they would send me out of the country every 3 months to get a just a 3 month temporary visa, and then they changed the law after that you could come in at a younger age. But I was the first one that ever was allowed in the kingdom under the age of 25 as a full-fledged, full-time engineer working for the oil company. And I did real well in my career, man. I mean, it was great. I loved it, you know. I mean, I was successful, and that was another thing that was hard, you know. I was flying around. We had three private 747s, you know, with sleeper seats in them. It only you know, the 747s hold 400 passengers. Ours only held 110 passengers. We had 20 stewardesses for 110 people. They would roll out carts of liquor, carts of caviar, carts of lobster, filet mignon, you know, and I was jet setting all over the world, you know. They'd call me up on my phone in Houston. They'd say, David, you know, they'd call me at 5:00 in the morning. Got a helicopter. It's going to pick you up at the Hilton Hotel in an hour and a half. This is 4:00 in the morning. Get your suitcase packed. A 12-passenger helicopter would pick me up, fly me out to Houston Continental Airport. It would take me 6.5 minutes to get there. Normally, it would take an hour and a half by car. It takes 6.5 minutes. We'd land right next to a 747. I'd see 400 people looking out the windows. I'd get out of this jet with my suitcase and my three-piece suit, and I'm 24 years old, and I'd walk straight on to first class. They'd just carry my bags on. They wouldn't even take them through customs or anything. And people would wonder, who is this guy? Who is that man? And I thought I was, you know, man, I'm something, you know. I am. I am somebody.
That's something like to me.
It was fun. But I look back at it now, you know, and it's a false sense of it's that ego, and that's what got me in trouble, you know. It was my ego, you know. And that's what made it so hard for me to get in, even though I got in at a fairly young age, you know. It still was that ego, you know, that, you know, I'm successful. Look at the money I'm making. Look at the way I'm traveling, man. I travel all over the world. I've lived or been in 26 countries in my life. You know, people dream about going to one country in their whole life. I've been to 26 of them. You know, I married my wife on an island in Greece. You know, things like that. People dream about that stuff. But anyway, so I flew to, so the oil business collapsed. I went out to California. And I had, you know, like I said, got about 3.5 years sobriety, and I started drinking again. Went out to California. And a couple months after I got out to California, I found Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I went back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And after about a year of sobriety, I met a nice lady that was in there. I was a year sober. She was 3.5 years sober. We got married. And I stayed sober for 8 years. And then I went back out. And she told me if I ever drank that she would leave me. And the day that she came home and she saw me drunk in the living room, she left, and she moved out. She moved into an apartment, and about a week later, I went over to her apartment that she was at, and another man was getting out of her shower, and I went down and filed for
divorce. Well, David, you got to remember, cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yes, exactly. But believe me, the woman's a wonderful woman. She's probably got 30, there's no doubt in my mind she's got at least 30-something years of sobriety now. And I had a huge part in that. I mean, she told me, you know, what the consequences were going to be, you know, if I went out and drank, you know, and I did. And I didn't get back in real, you know, like the very next day. But I, you know, so that marriage kind of went by the wayside. And then I decided one day, you know, hell, I'm going to, you know, by this time we had already left California, moved to South Carolina, done some other things. I'd taken her around the world and showed her all these countries and stuff. And then I found Austin. I said, well, I moved to Austin. And that's where I went out, and that's where we got divorced. And then I found out Alcoholics Anonymous again in Austin, and that's where I met Joseph. And I met
So what was your bottom? What was your bottom then at that point? I know you flopped in and out a couple times, but at that time, what was that bottom? What was the first bottom?
That bottom there was definitely losing my wife and losing my stepchildren, and just not being able to look at myself in the mirror anymore once again, you know. And so a lot of those things that they said were yets that I had never experienced before. I'd heard the old timers say, you know, I lost my wife, I lost my kids, I lost my job, I lost this. You know, those things were starting to happen to me real fast, real fast. And I said, man, I got to get back on the train again, man. I got to get back and plugged in again, because otherwise, you know, my life's going to go nowhere. So I was very lucky that I got back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober again, and then I met Julianne, you know, and she was just the most wonderful woman in my life. And, you know, I spent 15 years with that woman, and she never once saw me take a drink. And she, you know.
I really appreciate the sharing and the honesty and the reality. It's obvious to hear that it was a very, very touching, meaningful relationship, and you miss her very much.
We were driving home from dinner and a movie one night, and she had a heart attack, and she died in the car. And I tried to stay sober after that. And I managed to stay sober for another 11 months after that. And, you know, my ship just had a hole in it. It had a hole in it that I couldn't fill.
Yeah.
And,
you remember that you were also, when I met you, I remember it was a like a little pool party at who was it? I think it was over Terrence's place, Terrence C., and I met you, and I think you were just going through the beginnings, or you were through the middle of a Hep C regime with chemo.
Yeah. And I went through 2 years of chemotherapy for that, and a woman stuck through me through that, and I stayed sober through all of that. And
That's just kind of interesting. You had you went through the first bout of chemo, I think it was 18 months, and the way you explained it to me, it was like having the worst case of the flu you could imagine every day. And I remember there was a woman who had given up on it because she was just so sick she'd rather die. You went through 18 months of that, and of course there was a lot of stress on your relationship during that time, and you really hung in there.
I went through 24 months of it, actually. I went through 12 months of it. The doctor said most people can't make it even 3 months, and very rarely can they make it 6 months. If they make it to 12 months, they usually can get rid of the disease. Well, after 12 months, it was not gone. The disease had gotten worse. And Julianne was crying one night. She said she didn't want to lose me. And so I told her I'd go back. I got a chemo. You know, I said, I'll do it for you. You know, I don't care how hard it is, how sick I am every day. You know, I'll do it. And I went back on it for 12 more months. So I was on it for 24 months. And through the grace of God, I got through the disease, and it's gone, and I've been in remission ever since, you know. But this woman stuck with me.
How long was the second go-round? The second go-around was how long, when you went the experiment? I remember you were able to get the experimental drug out of Panama, because you were a dead man anyway, and the FDA, once you're in a critical state like that where you're going to die more than likely, they give you a lot of latitude in getting experimental drugs.
Yeah, and I was importing a drug from Panama through the DEA. I was the first one in the United States to ever use it for this. And I was on it for 12 months. But after 3 months, there was no trace of the Hep C anymore. There was no trace of it. But they wanted me to stay on it because of the trials and stuff, because of the money they were putting into it. They wanted me to stay on it for a full year. And so I did. And, you know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they were bringing meetings to my house. Every Tuesday they would come to my house, you know, and I'd be laying on the couch. I couldn't even get up off the couch. I was so sick. Sometimes I'd have a bucket next to me to throw up into, and there'd be 40 people at my house, you know, unfolding chairs, setting up a meeting for me in my house. And I tell you, the fellowship, it's just awesome, man.
My experience with it has just been
incredible. The support that I've gotten from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And that, just to continue on, you know, then after Julian died, you know, and I was talking to my sponsor outside of a meeting, and he shared with me that he had just caught his wife in bed with his best friend. And then his name was Joe. The next day his wife called me and she said Joe killed himself last night. Mm. And so I started going to my grand sponsor after that. And I was still staying sober, you know, and I was coming up on 15 years. And then 2 months after I hit 15 years, my grand sponsor had a heart attack and died. So all in 7 months, I lost my wife, I lost my sponsor, I lost my grand sponsor. And I just had this hole in my gut. My ship was going down. The ballast, you know how they say you have the ballast in the ship and they fill them up, you know. And I know that because I'm an engineer and I designed submarines. I should know about ballast, hell. I designed nuclear submarines for years. Anyway, my ballast, I just couldn't get my ballast straightened out, you know, and I just kept tilting a little bit further and further, and I couldn't get that one ballast filled back up to level my ship off, and that hole was getting bigger and bigger, and pretty soon I was isolating, and I was stopped going to meetings, and I stopped talking to people, and I was locked up in my room, you know, and I was just, it was just me and my thoughts and my ideas and my feelings and my depression and my demons, and they took over. And I said, you know what, I'm either going to kill myself or I'm going to drink. And I went out and I drank.
You've had some issues with suicide. And, you know, I think that the deal with your mother at such an early age probably was a trigger. Tell us about that.
Well, after Julianne died, before I drank, I did try to commit suicide, and once again, God intervened. I walked into the office of my house, and, you know, and here I am, you know, 15 years sober, and I said, yeah, I'm going to end it right now. So I tie an extension cord to a ceiling fan, and I barricade the doors to my office with filing cabinets and everything so that just in case somebody were to come home or to come into my house, they couldn't get to me, and I kicked the chair out, and bam, I'm hanging there. And I forget to close the blinds into my office, and the lady behind me just happened to be washing the dishes in her kitchen, and she looks out, and she sees me hanging myself in my office. So she dials 911, and the fire trucks come. They knock my front door completely off the door frame. They go rushing back to my bedroom. They're trying to use hatchets to get into my bedroom. I've got file cabinets barricaded in there. They can't get in that way, so they have to come in through the side wall of my house. They get into my office. They cut me down. They said my heart had stopped. They managed to resuscitate me and bring me back to life, and I didn't want to live. I said, why didn't you guys just let me go? God had plans for me, you know. I don't know to this day. I'm still searching, you know, what those plans are. But what I do know is that I'm back in Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I'm coming up on 2 more years again. And I'm sponsoring guys. And I'm carrying the message. And I'm helping people. And I still am trying to figure out sometimes why God didn't let me join Julianne. But that wasn't my choice. And so that's the last time I will ever try that. That's the last time I will ever do anything like that again. Because, even when I wanted to die, I couldn't die. I did the best attempt. I had a great teacher. My mom was the best teacher on to teach me how to kill myself. And God would not allow it. These guys chopped through my freaking wall of my house to get me down.
Wasn't there another time when you jumped out of a, what, 5 stories or 6-story building?
I jumped off a 6-story building and broke my back. I broke 13 ribs. I broke my leg. I broke my arm. I broke my neck. And I lived. Who jumps off a 6-story building and lives?
Nobody. Nobody that other than you.
Some lady said I bounced up 4 feet off the ground after I hit the ground. I bounced up. I don't remember anything from the second I hit because I was unconscious, you know. But, you know, I broke my back in 5 places, you know. I should have been paralyzed.
Were you drunk at the time?
No.
No, okay. Well, sometimes when you're really drunk and some folks will tell you that, like if you're really drunk and you're in a serious car accident, you'll oftentimes see the drunk walk away because he was just so relaxed that he didn't tense up and just went along with the impact.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But you didn't know, and then you jumped out of a tree too one time, wasn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, I ended up drinking again, and, you know, Joseph knows the story. I mean, he even got sick of being around me, you know. Nobody wanted to be around me, you know. I was just, I was a mess. I was a spiritual.
Well, I hung in for a long time, though.
Yeah.
I hung in.
Yeah, Joseph hung in.
I'm pretty tough. I hung in a long time, but you were getting, you were pretty far out. Well, the OxyContin, I think, was the big deal with you was, because your bones were percolated from all the chemo, right? Wasn't it? I mean, you had
I have a skeletal bone structure. Yeah, I have a secondary disease from the chemotherapy. It's called advanced transient osteoporosis, where it's a terminal disease where your bones eventually just all crumble. And I've since broken so many bones. You know, I've had my hips are held together with pins. My pelvic bones got pins in it. I got pins in my legs, pins in my wrists, pins in my thumbs. You know, I've broken all my ribs. I squatted down in my closet to pick up some tennis shoes, and all of a sudden I heard all these pops. I broke all 10 of my toes. They were just sticking up straight. They put me in 2 leg casts, you know. And I remember Joseph, we went out to New York, and Joseph pushed me around in a wheelchair, man. We were out there for a week, and for a week, Joseph pushed me around in a wheelchair. You know,
hey, I was still pretty strong. You were surprised I was moving you around pretty quick around Manhattan. We were moving.
You had
a great time. That was a great trip. That was the Lion King. That was the Lion King and the producers, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we went and saw the Lion King and the producers. And that's when your mother was really sick and dying, you know. And I got to meet Joseph's mother before she died, you know, which was a blessing.
That was, you know, I hadn't seen my folks in a while, and David offered to support me to go up there, and I don't think I could have did it without. She was on her deathbed, and so David came up and he says, "Look, I need to get out of here, and I think it'll be good for the both of us." And we went up to Pennsylvania, and I got to visit my mother. I think it was like 9 days before she passed on. And I got to read scriptures to her. And she said, I remember her asking me, David walks in. And she hadn't seen me in a couple of years. David walks in and standing over my mother's bed. And my mother turns around and goes,
is that you, Joe? What'd you say, David? Joseph, yeah. You look so different.
Joseph, you look...
Is that you, Joseph? I didn't know you had a mustache.
I didn't know what to say. I wanted to be there to support Joe, you know, and he was supporting me through the toughest time of my life. And I thought, you know, I need to give back. Maybe this will help, you know. I need to get out of town. I need to support somebody else too, you know. And Joseph's been just a great friend of mine ever since, and probably the best friend I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Joseph has dedicated his life to Rum Radio, and you know, sometimes I wish I had that kind of commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do my best, but man, I tell you. You won't find anybody that has any more of a commitment than Joseph.
Well, thank you, David. I like to think that it's a collaborative effort between me and God. God does 101% of the work, and I show up.
You know, I was hoping I wouldn't get emotional. Here I'm in my bedroom by myself. And next month, I got to get up in front of my home group, and I've got to do my story in front of them. And I haven't done this since Julianne died. And so maybe this was a good dry run for me, because I do not want to fall apart like this in front of my home group.
Well, you know what?
Well,
David,
you know.
Let me add
one little.
It's really, really, there's a healing quality to being able to cry and talk at the same time. I don't know why that is, but it is very healing. And the things you've shared today, and I know they're going to help a lot of people. I really appreciate your ability to shed some tears and talk. It's very, very
cool. And the fact that, you know what, I made it back even after all that. Even after all of that and losing my wife and all of that, I'm back in Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I'm coming up on 2 years again. You know, I'm coming up on 2 years, and I'm, and people are coming up. I'm sponsoring guys again, and like right now, if you were to ask me anything about my life is really good right now. It really is. I know I'm emotional because I'm talking about things that were really painful for me at the time, but my life is really good right now. It's getting right back on track like it did before. You know, I know God's got a plan for me, and I know it's good, and it's going to be good. And maybe I'll meet somebody again. It won't be like Julianne. It'll be somebody different. She'll be different. But I know I'll meet somebody. They're already coming up to me in AA, you know, like Joseph said. I just don't give them the time of day. I haven't wanted to. I haven't been out on a date or with a girl since Julianne died. But it isn't that I haven't had a chance. I've had lots of them. But I'm just now getting to the point where I'm ready to start engaging in some of that stuff again, maybe, you know? Maybe go out on a date here or there, you know? And get to be a little bit closer friends with women again. And maybe have somebody in my life that I can do things with again. And, you know, and all that's only because I'm sober again. I'd be sitting here in my room with a bottle of Jack Daniels over here next to my bed, you know, like I said, with my demons running through my head. But that doesn't go on, and it hasn't been going on for years now. And it's all just because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all because of that, you know, every single bit of it. And I've met a lot of friends now. You know, I've got a good home group. I've got a solid base. I got a guy that's moving in with me on the 15th. He's got 14 years of sobriety and 3 more days. He picks up his 14-year chip. You know, I mean, things are just going good. They're really going good. They really are. You know, I just hit a little emotional thing there for a minute talking with you guys, you know. But, you know, I have to tell anybody who's out there that's listening, you know. And, you know, I thought at 15 years I could get to anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I could work the steps. I thought I could talk to my sponsor, and he killed himself. And I thought I could talk to my grand sponsor, and he dies of a heart attack. And all of these things happened all at once, and I went out and drank. But you know what? So what? That's what I do. I'm an alcoholic. I drink. But I came back. I came back, and I'm giving again. I'm giving it back. I'm passing it on. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to pass it on to the alcoholic who still suffers. I'm not here suffering. These aren't tears of suffering. These are emotional tears from the past. I'm not suffering right now behind my past. I don't shut the door on it. I refuse to shut the door on my past. And I don't regret my past. I am who I am today because of everything that happened.
The greater the bigger the sinner, the greater the saint. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we could see how those experiences could help others. So the further down the scale we've gone, the greater the ability to help the next sufferer. Any comments, Harold? Any last words?
Well, I just really appreciate the honesty tonight and the great sharing. I want to encourage everybody, if you've been part of AA and you drank again, please come back. You don't lose your knowledge. You do lose the time that you accumulated, but you don't lose your knowledge. And David is a living example of that. So come back in, work the steps again, and we love you. I love what AA says. Let us love you till you can love yourself. Thanks for sharing, David.
Thank you very much, Harold. Thank you, Joseph.
Any last words, David?
Just keep coming back, folks. It gets better. It does. It doesn't matter how far down the scale we've gone. It does get better.
Thank you, David. Thank you for your service, and thank you for the share. That was very powerful. Actually, Harold said we 1,000. We had 1,500 listeners last week come into the show, and we've had as high as 1,700. And I don't know how many people how many people listen in Nashville, Kentucky, and Alabama. They don't keep a record of those, but we've been doing that for a couple years. So we're making an impact. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages. And we've gone over 300,000 hits to the website. And actually, that was about 6 months ago. I haven't really continued the tally. I figured that's sufficient for its need. We're probably we're quite a bit more than that. I get a lot of people tell me how much they appreciate the work and that it's saving people's lives. Now, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is sufficient unto itself, and the 12 and 12, we have some great information available to us. Rum Radio stays to that information. It's not anything outside of the information that's already been presented. The difference is it's like the Joe and Charlie tapes or the Chris Raymer circuit speaker. It's the same message presented in a different format. We have the right message. So remember, if you're going to sponsor somebody, try to figure out what's going on. Bill W. said, good sponsorship can mean the difference between life and death. So thank you, guys. And remember, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night, everyone.